Threads from the National Tapestry is now on YouTube. Search for Threads from the National Tapestry on YouTube and subscribe to our channel. On the channel, you'll find full podcast episodes paired with relevant photos and maps about each topic. It's another great way to listen to the show. Just search for Threads from the National Tapestry on YouTube and subscribe to our channel.
For those aboard the 50-gun USS Congress, it had been a quiet morning. Its crew, as usual, prepared the 20-year-old vessel for inspection, which would be held the next day. Meanwhile, the ship's quartermaster gazed out over Hampton Roads, which glistened under a late winter sun. All seemed normal. And then, at 12:45 p.m., a column of heavy black smoke. Curiosity aroused, the quartermaster turned to a fellow officer, handed him his glass, and asked for him to take a look. Their gaze created concern. Indeed, as the quartermaster put it, at last, that thing is a-coming. Something no one had ever seen before. Its mission? To change the course of the war. It was Saturday, March 8th, 1862. And one vessel, an ironclad, was about to alter centuries of naval warfare. This is the story of technology turning a page. This is the story of the duel between the ironclads.
The last five letters of history spell story. And that's exactly how history should be taught. Numbers and dates have no soul. Such presentations fall flat, for history is alive and relevant. Welcome to Threads from the National Tapestry, Stories from the American Civil War. This series will feature events and people from that period and will strive to make you feel as if you were there, to show that history is indeed a story.
That thing that was coming, the Confederate ironclad, the CSS Virginia, was not history's first, nor would be the USS Monitor. The addition of metal armor to a ship's side or deck was centuries old. In the 3rd century BC, the king of Syracuse reportedly built a merchant ship sheathed with lead. With iron-bound and studded shields lining the sides of their longboats, one could make an argument for Norsemen. In 1592, a Korean admiral repelled a Japanese naval attack with an iron-covered tortoise ship. In the 1780s, the Spanish built floating gun batteries, its weapons protected by slanting bulwarks plated with iron. Indeed, as late as the 1840s, British and American shipbuilders made iron-hulled vessels. Some for use in war, but none were expected to repel fire from an enemy vessel. A few other related turn of nautical events. In 1807, a significant naval achievement. Robert Fulton invented and demonstrated the first commercially successful steamboat. Vessels now made headway against the current. Yet for any Navy who hoped to adopt steam for military purposes, there were concerns. So much so that major navies of the world kept steam at arm's length. Engines and boilers took up space, space that was needed for storing ammunition and supplies. And boilers and engines were vulnerable to enemy fire. Then there was the design of the earliest steamships. Paddle wheels were easy targets, and again, occupied space where there might be armament. And requiring constant refueling, early steam engines were inefficient. But then, in 1836, English inventor Francis Pettit Smith and Swedish engineer John Ericsson changed the game. They came up with the screw propeller, which was more powerful and efficient. And its success meant engines and boilers could be placed in vessels below the waterline, protected from enemy fire. And that became a real concern, for as naval design advanced, so did naval ordnance. In the decade before Pettit Smith and Ericsson's technological advance, a French artillerist introduced the shell gun. Instead of a solid iron ball, this weapon fired a hollow shell filled with powder, which would explode upon impact or soon thereafter. No longer would shells bounce off ship sides or be buried harmlessly in timber. Now an explosion could spray lethal wood splinters, but still, it would be some 30 years before the shell gun's destructive power was realized. During the Crimean War, which pitted the Russian Empire against the ultimately victorious alliance of the Ottoman Empire, France, the UK, and Sardinia, Piedmont, and was fought from October 1853 to February 1856, a Russian fleet armed with shell shot decimated a Turkish squadron that entered the conflict in wooden vessels. And later, in the same war, both iron and the shell gun were employed. A few thinly clad floating batteries were also used and performed well. But it was the French who, after the Crimean War, produced a vessel that combined everything. In 1859, they launched the Gloire, a 253-foot steamer with a wooden hull, but whose sides had plates of iron armor 4.5 inches thick. Armed with shell guns, it became the first ocean-going ironclad. Within 2 years, and with Napoleon III's approval, there were another 20 of that class either completed or under construction. And, of course, the English followed. The same year as that first French ironclad was launched, the British began work on a 9,210-ton iron-cased ship, the Warrior. Sister ship Black Prince soon followed. And by 1861, Great Britain had 10 ironclads in service or under construction, some with 6.5 inches of iron plating. But at that time, none, the French or British, ever engaged one another in combat. That precedent would be left to Great Britain's former colony, which in April of 1861 slid into the abyss of civil war. True, at the time Fort Sumter fell to Confederate forces, the United States Navy consisted of some 90 vessels, many old and obsolete. The Confederate Navy had to begin from scratch, and it needed vessels that could crack Mr. Lincoln's blockade and give the South access to finished goods from the outside world. Enter native Floridian and Confederate Secretary of the Navy Stephen Russell Mallory. The lone Roman Catholic in Jefferson Davis's cabinet, and therefore somewhat suspect in a body of men who were largely Anglican and Presbyterian, Mallory knew that the Confederacy had to embrace the future. No question, Jefferson Davis benefited from this former United States senator who had served as chairman of the Naval Affairs Committee, and in that role was well aware of French and British innovation as it related to armored vessels. Realizing that the Confederacy had to be bold, he was determined that the Southern Navy must include ironclads and events. And the spring of 1861 presented him an opportunity. When Virginia seceded and Norfolk fell to Confederate forces, so did the Gosport Navy Yard, which was the largest and best-equipped shipyard in the country. Anticipating Virginia's mid-April secession, federal authorities prepared to destroy what they knew they could not hold. Something had to be done with extensive construction facilities that included a huge granite dry dock and numerous warehouses which stored cannon, gunpowder, shells, cannonballs, tools, steam engines, and more. And, in addition, 12 federal warships docked there. The most important of the 12 was the USS Merrimack. The 4,636-ton combination steam and sailing frigate had just returned from a tour of duty in the Orient and was laid up awaiting repairs and upgrade. Christened in 1854, she carried 40 guns, and with the Navy Yard threatened, the Merrimack had to leave port or be destroyed. All that became reality April the 17th, when the old Dominion state seceded. Orders were given to scuttle ships. Sea valves were opened and powdered charges laid. Aware that Virginia militia were moving in, the Merrimack in particular was a priority for destruction. At 4:20 a.m. of April the 18th, fuses were lit that ran to charges, and soon fires raged everywhere. But while the flames were seen for 30 miles, there was no explosion from charges that were also to blow up the dry dock. Despite the placing of 2,000 pounds of black powder, nothing. The dock survived, and that created nightmarish consequences for the North. On the evening of June the 3rd, the same day that Confederate Secretary Mallory arrived in the new Confederate capital, Richmond, he met with Ordnance Specialist Lieutenant John Mercer Brooke. Mallory asked him about the possibility of the South building its own ironclads. So charged, Brooke visited engineers at Tredegar Iron Works there in Richmond, and based upon their advice, believed one could be built locally. Its design, simple. Essentially, an armed raft powered by steam. Though quite rough, Mallory approved the design, and on June the 23rd, he and Brooke met with ship constructor John L. Porter. He, like Brooke, a former U.S. Navy veteran who went south. Joining the group was the Confederacy's chief engineer, William P. Williamson. After their meeting, Porter, a naval architect, began making a new set of designs while Brooke and Williamson searched for engines and boilers for the proposed vessel. That took them to Norfolk and the newly occupied naval yards at Gosport, where they inspected the ruins of the Merrimack, which had been razed May the 30th, and moved to the graving dock that survived Union destruction. Some believed little could be done with the Union frigate. Charred timbers, twisted brass and iron railings and fittings, ruined smokestack, most of its decking destroyed. And when raised by B&I Baker of Norfolk for $5,000, all of its iron parts had begun to rust. Still, Mallory saw something in it, and rather than starting from scratch, work began to resurrect her, to convert her to an ironclad at an estimated cost of $172,523. Mallory's hopes were further buoyed by the fact that although the frigate had been submerged in the Elizabeth River, its engine suffered only minor damage. Porter was to supervise the construction. Brooke was to see to armor and weaponry, and Williamson to oversee refitting the engine and other machinery. There was one real concern. The vessel's draft was 23 feet, too deep for operation anywhere near shoal water. No matter, the Confederate Congress gave its legislative blessing. In the very same week that Secretary Mallory sent orders for the Merrimack to be turned into an ironclad, Mr. Lincoln's Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, submitted his first report to the United States Congress. As did his Confederate counterpart, he mentioned British and French efforts to construct ironclads, but unlike Mallory, did not suggest any urgency. And quite honestly, Congress shared that complacency. In his report, Welles feared diplomatic and logistical challenges to Lincoln's proposed blockade of southern ports. And he pointed out that 42 vessels of the Federal Navy were obsolete and totally inadequate to fulfill such a task. Yet, to comply with the president's wishes, he sent agents to every seaport to buy up anything that floated and was large enough to carry a gun. And then there was the overriding concern to protect Washington City, which sat, of course, on the banks of the Potomac. To do that, he had to protect the Chesapeake Bay. And in turn, that meant holding Hampton Roads, which fortunately for him was still in Union hands, dominated by Fort Monroe's guns, and in addition, where a large squadron of Union warships were stationed. Spies heightened Welles' concern, for they reported the Confederacy had razed the Merrimack and word was turning her into an ironclad. A federal ironclad program suddenly took on great urgency. He needed a man who might light a fire under Congress, and that man was Cornelius S. Bushnell, a sharp 31-year-old venture capitalist from New Haven, Connecticut, who had a reputation for getting things done. Within a short time, Wells and Bushnell not only had Bill 36 ready, but had convinced Iowa's U.S. Senator James Grimes to introduce it. The measure called for $1.5 million to construct ironclad ships. With rumors about the prospect of an iron-plated Merrimack, Bill 36 passed, and on August the 3rd, Lincoln signed it into law. Wells immediately advertised for designs and set up an advisory board. Of the 17 received, the board chose two plans: a steam frigate, the New Ironsides, proposed by Philadelphia's Merrick and Sons, and an ironclad gunboat, the Galena, which had been submitted by Cornelius Bushnell and Company of New Haven. The two chosen, the three-man board, which was comprised of conservative old salts, wasn't excited about either, and Bushnell knew it. He therefore made a suggestion. The man who helped to invent the screw propeller back in 1842, John Ericsson, had a design, and Bushnell believed the Swede's was better. However, there was a problem. Ericsson and the United States Navy were not happy with one another. Some 20 years earlier, Ericsson designed the USS Princeton and on it installed two 12-inch guns, both of his own design. In 1844, during a gunnery display on the Potomac, one of his big guns, nicknamed the Peacemaker, exploded, killing six, included two of President John Tyler's cabinet. Though no charges were formally filed, the Navy refused to pay Ericsson, and he, incensed and embittered, swore he'd never set foot in Washington City again. Despite that unfortunate history, Bushnell traveled to Ericsson's home in New York City and asked him to review his own plans for the Galena. The Swedish engineer said Bushnell's vessel would work, but turned the tables when he asked if Bushnell would look over the designs of an ironclad of his own. With that, Ericsson reached into a dust-covered desk and produced a cardboard model of a strange low-setting vessel that had a revolving turret, and he immediately began to explain how quickly and economically it could be built. Bushnell, convinced Ericsson's design was better than his own, went to work repairing burned bridges between Ericsson and the United States Navy. Thanks to the intervention of Bushnell, Secretary of State William Seward, two noted New York iron manufacturers, and the ironclad board met on September the 13th, 1861, to hear Bushnell's presentation on behalf of Ericsson's design. Included in the meeting, Abraham Lincoln. Plan revealed, it was applauded and questioned at the same time. And at some point, the 16th president offered this opinion. All I have to say is what the girl said when she put her foot into the stocking. It strikes me there's something in it. The discussion carried over into the next day. And though Lincoln was intrigued, the board opted not to accept Ericsson's design. One, Commander Charles H. Davis didn't hold back when he commented to Bushnell, "Take the little thing home and worship it, as it would not be idolatry, because it was made in the image of nothing in the heaven above or on the earth below or in the waters under the earth." Crestfallen Bushnell held on to one last resolve, and it was as challenging as defending the radical design to three traditionalists: convince Ericsson to come to the Capitol and defend his own design. The two met again, and Bushnell used a masterful tactic. He played upon the Swede's vanity, and rather than speak of the board's refusal to accept his design, he explained that the board had a few questions that required further explanation. The two took a train that night to Washington City. Yet, when Erickson arrived at the Navy Department, he learned the truth, that his plan had been turned down. And not only was he an unexpected guest, but unwelcomed as well. He almost stormed out of the room, but before doing so, asked why his design had been rejected. Commodore Joseph Smith said, lack of stability. That, to the engineer, had to be addressed. And Erickson launched into a riveting explanation about the physical principles that allowed a vessel to float. Then he followed that up with what his ship could do. After holding the three board members spellbound for an hour, he concluded with, gentlemen, I consider it to be your duty to the country to give me an order to build the vessel before I leave this room. How long to build it? To Navy Secretary Gideon Welles, Erickson said he could build the ironclad in 90 days and at a cost of $275,000. That sealed the deal. And in doing so, the board expanded the time of completion another 10 days, 100. And so, Erickson raced back to New York, made more than 100 detailed drawings, and sent them to northern manufacturers that would make the parts his vessel would require. And that included an expert construction crew up at Brooklyn's Continental Iron Works, which laid the keel October the 25th, 1861. And so it began, both North and South chasing the future of naval design and warfare. Eventually naming her the Monitor, Erickson's vessel would be very different from the Confederacy's ironclad. The Monitor was only 172 feet long. Think of an American football field, some 57 yards. She was 41 feet, 6 inches wide, just under 14 yards wide. Her hull, iron and flat-bottomed. Her draft, half that of the future Confederate ironclad, 10 feet and 6 inches. Ideal for southern coastal waters and rivers. On top of the hull, a flat wooden deck covered with two layers of half-inch iron plates. And armor draped over her sides like an iron skirt, to protect her from ramming and shots fired at the waterline. Just slightly off-center, its signature feature, a cylindrical revolving turret that rose 9 feet and had an inside diameter of 20 feet. The turret, layered with 8 1-inch layers of iron plating and turned by a small steam engine. It rested in a grooved bronze ring that set into the deck. Inside, 2 11-inch Dahlgrens. Capable of throwing a 180-pound shell, each required some 7 to 8 minutes to reload. The vessel would be piloted by her captain and helmsman, who would be in a small iron pilot house some 55 feet forward of the turret. That pilot house had 5 8-inch high eye slits on all sides. That element was one of the last items to be completed, and as time would tell, had an inherent flaw. It sat so low that it affected visibility, and yet so high that the guns in the turret could not fire directly ahead without hitting it. Another Erickson invention, its engine, was connected to a crankshaft that propelled a 4-bladed propeller. The little ship could make 6 knots. Her exhaust vented through a smokestack that could be dismantled when going into battle. On the 30th of January, 1862, though 18 days later than the contract mandated, she made her maiden voyage. Northern Industries allowed Monitor to be completed in half the time the Confederacy needed to overhaul the Merrimack. On February the 25th, the United States Navy commissioned the Monitor and selected Lieutenant John L. Worden to command her. He, who had been captured earlier in the war in exchange, now began the task of recruiting 57 men to serve as his crew. On March the 6th, 1862, assisted by a tugboat and 2 gunboats, the USS Monitor left New York Harbor. Its orders? report to the federal squadron that blockaded Hampton Roads, then proceed up the Potomac to protect the federal capital. Much earlier, down in Richmond, Mallory labored to complete work on the Merrimack. Given $2 million for the Confederate Ironclad program by its Committee on Naval Affairs, his task was most formidable, for Southern technicians were in short supply. And to highlight that challenge, not one shipyard in the South was even able to build a small warship from scratch. And only one Confederate rolling mill, Richmond's Tredegar Iron Works, could produce the required sheet iron, and it was already backlogged with filling orders from Confederate armies and railroads. As one might expect, Brooke, Williamson, and Porter were busy. After Williamson resurrected the Merrimack's machinery, Porter covered it with a new gun deck. Its 178-foot fort-like casemate longer than the monitor itself. It was bolstered by 20-inch pine timbers, planked with 4 inches of oak, then plated with 2 2-inch layers of sheet iron. One iron layer fastened horizontally and the next vertically. And the sheets extended 2 feet below the waterline and 7 feet above the waterline to discourage ramming and near misses. The fortified casemate was slanted at 35 or 36 degrees to deflect enemy fire. Within, 10 big guns, 3 9-inch smoothbore Dahlgrens, and 1 6-inch rifled cannon on each broadside. At the ship's bow, a 7-inch pivot gun, and another at the stern. For the aforementioned smoothbores, Brooke cut spiral grooves into the bores and fit red hot iron bands over the powder chambers, which shrank when they cooled. By doing that, he reinforced the now rifled guns to handle heightened firing pressures. The Merrimack's final weapon? A massive 1,500-pound cast-iron prow for ramming enemy vessels. Just as Union officials were aware that a Confederate ironclad was being built, so too those working on the Merrimack were aware that an ironclad was being constructed up north. That news prompted urgency to complete the task. But Tredegar had constant delays. So much so that with Brooke's constant badgering, it took the ironworks in Richmond until February of 1862 to turn out the 723 tons of armor plating that were needed. And February was 3 months after Merrimack's scheduled launching. Finally, on February the 17th, 1862, after 9 months of intense labor, the ironclad was commissioned and renamed the Virginia. Quite honestly, the launch was anticlimactic. No governors or dignitaries were on hand, no band, no crowd. When water flowed in and the ship began to slide out into the Elizabeth River, only 5 men stood on her deck, 4 Marine privates and a corporal. Though commissioned, much work still had to be done, from bow to stern. 262 feet, just over 87 American football yards. And even at her launching, defects were immediately noted. Despite extensive caulking at all her seams, there were leaks. Ventilation bad. There was a shortage of flannel to make gunpowder bags. The ram was not well mounted. And worst of all, it seems that Porter miscalculated the ship's weight. As the Virginia floated out into the Elizabeth River, her fore and after decks were exposed. And even in slight swells, the casemate's iron eaves, instead of extending 2 feet below water, barely made waterline. That meant hundreds of tons of pig iron had to be loaded bow to stern in unused storerooms. Yet, by March the 5th, with everything but powder aboard, the Virginia's fore and after decks rode barely awash. The casemate was only some 6 inches below the waterline. It remained to be seen if this might prove an Achilles' heel for the Southern monster. Now, Virginia needed a 300-man crew. So difficult this task proved to be that Confederate Army camps at Yorktown, Richmond, and Petersburg were scoured. Unlike rounding up the crew, finding 30 experienced naval officers was easy, for several hundred had gone south when the war began. Still, the vessel, officers, and crew needed a captain. And on February the 24th, Mallory chose Commodore Franklin Buchanan. 61 years of age, the native Marylander was the grandson of a signer of the Declaration of Independence. At 14, Buchanan became a midshipman and served aboard the USS Constitution and Constellation. In 1845, he submitted a plan for a naval academy and became its first superintendent. Like many, when war came, he expected his slave-holding native state of Maryland would secede. So, declaring that he could not raise his hand against his native state, he, after 46 years in the United States Navy, bade a tearful farewell. A footnote, when Maryland did not secede, he asked Secretary of the Navy in Wells to reinstate him and was told, "Your name has been stricken from the rolls of the Navy." And so Buchanan took charge of a vessel that, though it had defects, was formidable. A vessel that was about to change naval warfare. And Stephen Mallory dearly hoped so. For 1862 thus far had been one Confederate disaster after another. The fall of Forts Henry and Donelson, which opened the Tennessee River into the Confederate heartland, and fall of Roanoke Island, North Carolina, which allowed a back door to Richmond. Like Mallory, Buchanan, described as the beau ideal of a naval officer of the old school, with tall form, harsh features, and clear, piercing eyes, well, he knew there was a sense of urgency for the use of his own iron leviathan. Buchanan wanted action, prompt and successful action. And though he was not fully aware of the exact timetable, there was indeed a race. For as William C. Davis noted in his work Duel Between the First Ironclads, at 4 p.m. on March the 6th, and with crowds of men and women watching, the USS Monitor cast off her line, backed away from her Brooklyn wharf, and steamed down the East River into New York Harbor to meet her appointment with history. The transit did not go without danger. With her low freeboard, if only 2 feet of water came into her bottom, she would sink. Even in a light sea, there was cause for concern. As she hugged the coast, the vessel's Currituck and Sachem steamed as escorts on Monitor's flanks. Some 400 feet ahead, the Seth Lowe towed with heavy hawser. Now in open water, a safety precaution almost backfired. Before leaving the Navy Yard, Monitor's turret was raised slightly from its ball bearings, and a rough hemp rope was placed between bottom and brass rings. The rope proved a bad seal, and water came in under the turret like a waterfall. A storm added to their distress. Waves broke in over the ship's 6-foot-high smokestack, and with water pouring in, boiler fire suffered, creating smoke, steam, and gas. After successfully signaling the Seth Lowe, and that in itself took some doing, Monitor, after some 5 hours of labored towing, was taken closer to shore, and that helped immensely. By noon of March the 8th, after the perilous journey, a group of ships passed Cape Charles, the southernmost point of the Maryland Peninsula, and entered Chesapeake Bay. Fort Monroe and Hampton Roads were not far away, yet destiny favors the bold. And in this race of ironclads, the Virginia won. Saturday, March the 8th. Good weather. So good that Buchanan decided the Virginia would move. Responding to orders that only he knew, the ship's sloping casemate was smothered with tallow, pig fat, ship's grease to help deflect cannon fire. At 11 a.m., crewmen cast off her lines, and the Confederate ironclad slowly steamed out of the Gosport Naval Yard and north down the Elizabeth River to attack the Federal fleet in Hampton Roads. Accompanied by various small craft, which included two small gunboats, the Raleigh and Beaufort, she slid along like a half-submerged crocodile. Crowds from Portsmouth and Norfolk lined the banks of the Elizabeth. Some cheered. Some predicted failure. One cynic shouted, "Go on with your metallic coffin. She will never amount to anything else." Indeed, moving at perhaps 5 knots, she was difficult to steer and more sluggish than anticipated. Confederate Lieutenant John Taylor Wood remembered, she was as unmanageable as a waterlogged vessel. Buchanan prayed she wouldn't run aground. Around noon, the Virginia passed Craney Island at the mouth of the Elizabeth River, and it was then that Buchanan informed his officers and crew of their mission. To first attack the 24-gun sailing sloop Cumberland and 50-gun sailing frigate Congress off Newport News, then swing eastward and strike two steam frigates, the 40-gun Minnesota and 40-gun Roanoke, which were several miles closer to Union-held Fort Monroe. At 1:08, a Union lookout vessel raised signal number 551. The enemy was approaching. 2 minutes later, the Confederate ironclad could be seen clearly. As an observer put it, pretty soon that great black thing, different from any vessel ever seen before, poked her nose around Sewell's Point. One of the first to sight Virginia was the Federal gunboat Zouave, which opened fire. Its shells harmlessly bounced away. The Virginia ignored the Union vessel's fire, and from Union shore batteries then closed to within a mile of the Cumberland, whose rigging was still filled with Saturday's wash, and according to tradition, whites to the starboard and blues to port. With Buchanan's blessing, a lanyard was jerked on the Virginia's 7-inch bow gun, and its shell screamed across Hampton Roads. It struck the Cumberland and passed through the starboard quarter rail, spraying flying, lethal splinters. Several on the crew on board the 24-gun sloop, while frantically taking down its wash, double-charging powder in their guns and spreading sand to absorb the anticipated human gore, became casualties. Virginia's second shot detonated amongst a forward gun crew and killed everyone except the powder monkey and gun captain, who lost both arms at the shoulder. By now, Federal fire peppered the Confederate ironclad from the Cumberland, Congress, and Union land batteries positioned at Newport News. Though hammered, each shell glanced away. Buchanan then gave the order for full speed ahead. He intended to ram the Cumberland. By now, around 2:30, the Virginia was only about 300 to 400 yards from its intended victim, and its line brought her abreast the USS Congress, which unleashed a starboard broadside at the lumbering Confederate ironclad as it passed by. Its fire had no effect other than prompting a Confederate starboard broadside of its own. Some of the Confederate shells were hot shot, projectiles heated to a glowing red in a furnace below the gun deck, hauled up in an iron bucket, placed in a muzzle by means of tongs gripping holes in the ball, and once placed, rolled back against a water-soaked wad which separated it from the powder charge. Ram in another water-soaked wad, then fire. Poured into the belly of a wooden vessel, fire was the inevitable result. That Confederate broadside wreaked havoc on the Congress. In addition to destroyed guns, carriages, and horrific wounds, fires did indeed break out. And all the while, Virginia never veered from its path toward the Cumberland. A land-based northern reporter noted, "Now she nears the Cumberland sloop of war, silent and still, weird and mysterious, like some devilish and superhuman monster, or the horrid creation of a nightmare." Aboard the intended victim, the dead were thrown out of the way to the port side of the deck, while wounded were taken below. It continued to fire, and though it had little effect on piercing the enemy's iron plating, it did shoot away the Virginia's flagstaff, riddle its smokestack, and rake everything on the ironclad's exterior. Inside the Confederate casemate, the heat and noise were terrible, but its gun crew protected and unharmed. And though they were safe, their captain was not, as he foolishly stood in an open hatch exposed. Nearing the Union ship, the engine room heard three gongs, reverse engines. Buchanan wanted to be able to withdraw after ramming. Then came impact. Virginia's 1,500-pound iron ram, attached to several hundred tons of ship and propelled at some 6 knots, smashed its way through a ring of timber surrounding the Union ship meant to protect her, then tore into the Cumberland starboard just below the waterline. The ramming produced a gaping hole, big enough that one could have driven a horse and cart through it. And into that yawning hole, Virginia fired a shell into the belly of the now desperately wounded ship. While few of the Virginia's crew felt the collision, water now poured into the Cumberland, causing it to immediately list to the starboard, and in doing so, bore down on the ram's iron prow, which forced the Virginia down by the bow with her. With the two locked together, the two began to drift parallel to one another, and furious, lethal broadsides belched from both. The fire so intense from and on the Virginia that the grease which had been smeared on its sides began to pop and crackle. One Confederate gunner shouted, "Don't this smell like hell?" and was answered by another, "It certainly does, and I think we'll all be there in a few minutes." Confederate engines strained to back her out, but it was the tidal current that finally freed her. A fortunate wave rolled the Federal ship slightly. Tension on Virginia's bow was relieved, and the Confederate ironclad broke free, but not without damage to itself. Cumberland's weight snapped the flawed ram, and it broke off. As one Confederate put it, "Like a wasp, we could sting but once." Now separated, but by only some 20 feet, the two continued to hurl tons of iron at one another. An observer noted, "The shot and shell from the Virginia crashed through the wooden sides of the Cumberland as if they had been made of paper, carrying huge splinters with them and dealing death and destruction on every hand. Several entered one side of the Union ship and passed out through the other, carrying everything before them." The deck of the Union sloop was awash in human gore. One gunner had both legs shot away, yet took 3 steps on the bleeding stumps to fire a final shot before falling dead. It went on for nearly a half hour, while water continued to drag the Cumberland down. Around 3:35 in the afternoon, the order was given to abandon ship. She went down with a great roar, plunging until her hull struck sandy bottom 54 feet below. Yet, top of her main mast protruded from the water, its colors still flying. In its encounter with the Cumberland, the Virginia did suffer some damage beyond the loss of her ram. Specifically, when Union fire was aimed at the Confederate ironclad's gun ports. 2 of Virginia guns had ends of their muzzles broken off, but as to the integrity of the ship, she was fine. Encased in smoke, Buchanan now turned his attention to the wounded Congress. But to do so, his ship had to go upriver and turn about. She did so in a wide, slow turn, her keel dangerously dragging through the mud all the while. While she did, escort ships for both continued to fire, and several Union ships raced to aid Congress. But in doing so, the Roanoke, Minnesota, and St. Lawrence all ran aground. Congress was on her own. Little Zouave did put her into tow and was making headway to shallower water, but at around 4 p.m., Virginia had completed her turn and positioned itself where it could rake Congress's stern with broadsides. Only 200 yards apart, Confederate fire was murderous. soon, Congress's two Stern guns were knocked out of action. And to make matters worse, she in tow also ran aground. The ship was doomed. Spying a white flag, Buchanan sent the Beaufort and Raleigh to receive her surrender and take on her crew. However, when the two did, fire erupted from the encamped 20th Indiana on land at Newport News. There, an Army captain questioned the order to fire which had been given by Brigadier General Joseph Mansfield. When he reminded his general that the Congress had surrendered, Mansfield stormed, "I know the damn ship has surrendered, but we haven't." Once Buchanan learned what had happened, he was livid. With "destroy that damn ship," Virginia closed and poured hot shot into the Congress. And while that went on, Buchanan called for a rifled musket and, standing atop, fully exposed, fired back at Union sharpshooters on the shore. His rashness backfired when he was hit in the left thigh and taken below. Confederate command now fell to Lieutenant Catesby Jones. With the Congress run aground and from bow to stern licking with flames, he turned his attention to another grounded Union vessel, the Minnesota. By now, the St. Lawrence and Roanoke had freed themselves from the mud and muck and sent their tugboats to try to rescue the stranded Union frigate. Even as the Virginia lumbered its way, a couple of positives for the Virginia. Sunlight was fading, and with the tide dropping, Virginia could not close. Strongly advised by his pilots, Jones ordered the Virginia to retire. And so, at around 6:30, the Virginia, having passed through the South Channel to the mouth of the Elizabeth River, fired her last gun and dropped anchor under the protection of Southern land batteries on Sewell's Point. In 4 hours of combat that Saturday, the CSS Virginia dealt the United States Navy the worst defeat in its history, a defeat that would not be topped until December the 7th, 1941. That day, March the 8th, 1862, wooden ships were rendered obsolete. In 4 hours on one afternoon, one lone vessel had totally reversed strategic balance along the east coast of North America. That night, Lieutenant Jones surveyed his vessel. He found a small leak in the bow where the ram had been wrenched off. Anchors, flagstaffs, and howitzers on deck had been shot away, its smokestack and vent pipe riddled. Both of the ironclad's lifeboats were gone, and to repeat, the muzzle of two guns had been shot away. And yes, there were 98 indentations where enemy balls had struck, but none pierced its iron plating. Virginia's casemate had successfully stood its first test. Confederate officials in Richmond were ecstatic. There was talk of sailing into New York Harbor, besieging every major northern port. Up in Washington City, the mood was black. Informed of the disaster by telegraph, Lincoln called an emergency cabinet meeting. Gideon Welles hurried to the executive mansion and found Secretary of State William Seward, Treasury Secretary Salmon Chase, and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton already there. Welles never liked Stanton and found him in a mood that, as the Navy Secretary described, inexpressively ludicrous. Pacing about the room like a madman, eyes contemptuously darting at Welles, Stanton was completely beside himself. His rant included that the Virginia would wreck every ship the Navy had, threaten every eastern seaport, prevent any movement by the Army up the James River, and Washington City and New York and Boston would be destroyed. Every now and then he walked over to a window which presented a clear view of the Potomac and state that any minute now they could have a shell through the very window where he gazed. He demanded what would the Navy do, and Welles told those assembled that, one, the Monitor was on its way, and, two, the Virginia's draft was too deep for her to come up the Potomac. With that second fact, Seward relaxed. Stanton did not, and excitedly asked how many guns the Monitor carried. Welles gave her dimensions, character, and then answered she had two guns. That sent Stanton to even greater theatrics, so much so that later he sent wires to the governors of New York, Massachusetts, and Maine, advising them to prepare for the Confederate monster. Sunday, March 9th. A little after 6:30 a.m., Lieutenant Jones got the Virginia steam up, weighed anchor, and put out into Hampton Roads. Though fog shrouded the scene, it promised to be yet another beautiful day. Accompanied by Patrick Henry, Jamestown, and Teaser, Jones and the Virginia steamed north. There were other smaller craft, these filled with spectators, and like the day before, the banks were lined by thousands of the curious. The squadron of vessels meant to finish off the Minnesota, but as they neared, they found it was no longer alone. Positioned in front of the grounded Union frigate, a cheese box on a raft. It was the Monitor. Erickson's creation had arrived in Hampton Roads around 9 p.m. the night before. Captained by Lieutenant Warden, he reported to Commodore John Marston, who was in charge of United States Navy operations in Hampton Roads. Warden, a native New Yorker, had been in the United States Navy since 1834. Though slight and soft-spoken, he was a lion in battle. Recently exchanged from a southern prison in November of 1861, he, upon his arrival, was to report, then bypass Hampton Roads and steam directly to Washington City. However, given the crisis at Hampton Roads, Marston wisely chose to ignore Gideon Welles' direct order. It would become yet another of this conflict's thousands of what-ifs. The sight of this tin can on a shingle surprised the crew of the Virginia. No sails, no wheels, no apparent smokestack and guns. And positioned in front of the Minnesota, it appeared a pygmy before a giant. To the few atop the Monitor's turret, there was a chrysanthemum of white smoke from their assailant's bow gun and the screaming hiss of a shell that raced over them and struck the Minnesota. All descended before joining shipmates, of which many had not slept for 48 hours. Warden ordered his ship to meet the oncoming Virginia. Confederate ironclad hoped to get about 1/2 mile from the Minnesota, then pepper her with broadsides. But Monitor's position now made that impossible. It was about 8:45 a.m., and the two primordial naval beasts joined in unprecedented battle. After firing at long range, the two closed to within 50 yards, then began to circle one another. The distance would open to about 100 yards, then close to almost brushing against one another. The Monitor's light draft and better engines meant she maneuvered more efficiently, and Jones on the Virginia complained that he could not get a good look at his enemy. Indeed, the best opportunity he would have was when Monitor was about to fire. After each salvo, its turret turned away while reloading commenced. As shells ricocheted off both vessels, within the Confederate casemate there were scenes from Dante's Inferno. Dense smoke, silent, begrimed men bathed in sweat, soot, and burned powder. Within the Monitor's turret, a far different scene, particularly after Virginia's first shots glanced off the 8-inch plates that encased Monitor's turret. Just as the crew of the Virginia found the day before, those inside the Monitor found issues once battle began. The two port stoppers, which opened to run out a gun and close while reloading, were such that only one gun could be fired at a time. And once closed, gunners had trouble using long pole rammers. When they fired, they had little idea of the effect of their fire. Another issue. Gunners discovered that they could not fire if the Virginia was directly ahead for the position of the pilot house, too high. And then, during Monitor's treacherous trip down the coast, incoming seawater rusted some of the machinery that turned the turret. It could turn, but not precisely. Virginia continued to have her share of issues as well. With the loss of her ram the day before, she leaked badly at its bow. And as the amount of seawater increased in her hold, the Confederate ironclad steered miserably. It took some 15 minutes for the Virginia to present a broadside to the Monitor, and her riddled smokestack was such that the air inside the casemate was fouled. Not enough fresh air for its boiler fires to efficiently provide power as well. And yet, both ironclads took comfort that other than indentations and some cracked plates on the Virginia, both ships could do little damage to the other. For some 2 hours, the two belched tons of shot and shell at the other. Then, about 10:30, with all its circling, Virginia ran aground. Monitor approached and fired 180-pound projectiles on the stricken ship at will and from every angle. For some 15 minutes, gunners inside the Monitor fired shot after shot at near point-blank range. More cracks in the armor plating appeared on the Virginia, and some shots were so aimed and powerful that some of the backing timber on the Virginia were actually forced back. Down in the bowels of the grounded Confederate ironclad, fast-burning combustibles were fed to the fire to try to get up more steam pressure. With the pressure gauge pinned, Virginia's prop churned water and mud. More oiled cotton waste, splinters of wood, even turpentine were fed to the fires. Finally, there was a slight jar. Then Virginia broke free. She backed out into deeper water, and the fight continued. It was about this time that Jones made the decision to ram his opponent. It would take about an hour to maneuver her into position, and about a mile of water for Virginia to get up full headway. But in the heat of the moment, she only had about a half mile. Viewing from the slit in the pilot house, Warden realized what was about to happen. He ordered Monitor to turn just enough so that the blow would be oblique and not head-on. And Jones, remembering the near disaster from the day before when ramming the Cumberland, gave the order far before impact to reverse engines. The blow, as a result, was a half punch. The Monitor was not breached, and in fact, just as Virginia made contact, the Monitor fired both guns. Their impact was halfway up the casemate, and the side near the aft pivot gun jerked back some 2 or 3 inches. The concussion bowled over most in the aft gun crews, and many got to their feet bleeding from nose and ears. Concussion was also a problem within the Monitor's turret. Anyone careless enough to lean against its walls begged for injury. It was about this time that Warden pulled the Monitor out of the fight so that he might replenish his supply of shot to the turret. The rearming took about a half an hour. While it did, Jones concentrated on the Minnesota. It was now about 11 a.m. More Confederate shot and shell pelted the helpless Federal frigate. One shot shell plowed through 4 rooms, caused an explosion of powder, and that in turn created a fire that was quickly put out. Finally, Monitor steamed back into the fight. By this time, Jones aboard the Virginia realized his ship could not injure his adversary, so entertained the notion to board the Monitor, drive wedges into the turret to restrict its movement. Yet they missed their chance when Monitor steamed away and the moment passed. Now, incredibly, Warren decided he would ram the Virginia to aim his vessel at her most vulnerable point, Virginia's stern, damage her rudder and propeller, render her unnavigable. At full speed, Monitor raced, but at the last moment, an issue developed with the steering mechanism, and she sheared away, just missing her objective, and that allowed Virginia an opportunity. As Monitor glided past Virginia's stern, John Taylor Wood jerked the lanyard on his aft pivot gun and at only a distance of some 20 yards fired at the Monitor's pilot house. It was a direct hit. There was a flash of light, a cloud of smoke, and Warden, who had been at the pilot house's slit, staggered back and exclaimed, "My eyes! I am blind!" The Confederate shell had struck the 9-by-12-inch iron log on the pilot house, broke it, and stove the entire pilot house back several inches. Warden's face was painted with powder and iron. Blackened blood ran like tears down his face. Helped below by others, Lieutenant Samuel Dana Green assumed command. While this occurred, Monitor's pilot turned the vessel away from the Virginia. Getting Warden below, transferring command to Green, and assessing damage probably took some 30 minutes. And when the Monitor, about noon, turned to rejoin the fight, she had ventured into shoal water. Too shallow for Virginia to follow. So again, Jones turned his ship attention to the Minnesota. But despite all the technological innovations of that day, nature was about to have her say. The tide was receding. Maybe just high enough to get the Virginia over the sandbar and back into the relative safety of the Elizabeth River. So shortly after the noon hour, Virginia broke off. Both ships believed they had won the encounter. Both believed the other had withdrawn. In effect, it was a tactical draw. And though there was doubt about who won, one fact was absolutely certain. What had taken place out in Hampton Roads that morning was a revolution in naval warfare. As we've mentioned before, wooden ships were doomed. Iron was the new king of the seas. And yet, though naval history had been made and tactically the encounter had been a draw, strategically, it was a Union victory. The Confederacy needed a decisive win. Instead, its one-day advantage had now been neutralized. The arrival and success of the Monitor men Hampton Roads was still in Union hands. Yes, the Confederacy still held the James, Nansemond, and Elizabeth Rivers, and with that last river, Norfolk itself. But all that would change when in only weeks, Major General George B. McClellan's Peninsula Campaign forced Confederate withdrawal from all those points just mentioned. Utterly unseaworthy, and its draft too deep to allow escape up the James River toward Richmond, on the night of May 10th and 11th, 1862, the CSS Virginia was beached and blown up to keep her from falling into Union hands. It was shortly before 5 a.m. when fires reached Virginia's magazine. The detonation created such a concussive roar that for miles around, surrounding forest and houses shook. And then, as the then last captain of the South's first ironclad, Commodore Josiah Tatnall, put it succinctly in a report to Navy Secretary Mallory, "The Virginia no longer exists." Erickson's Monitor survived only 7 months more. On Christmas Day, 1862, orders were conveyed for the USS Rhode Island to put the Monitor in tow for delivery to Beaufort, North Carolina, where she was to assist the blockade there. Bad weather delayed the departure to December 29th. At 2 p.m. that afternoon, the two left Hampton Roads on a smooth sea. Yet, instead of Beaufort, Monitor had a date with North Carolina's graveyard of the Atlantic. For in a raging storm at about 1 a.m., December the 31st, 1862, the men on the Rhode Island watched the ironclad's lights disappear. The little Monitor rolled over. Her turret came loose, and with it touching bottom first, her hull settled at an angle atop its signature structure. 15 miles south of Cape Hatteras, almost within sight of land. The USS Monitor sank in 240 feet of water. 47 of the so-called Monitor boys were miraculously rescued by the crew of the Rhode Island. 16 perished. After their March 9th encounter, the two never engaged in armed combat again. They confronted one another, but never as they did on that sun-splashed, history-making Sunday. Yes, the Confederacy built more ironclads, all with the same casemated design. Some 50 were planned. 22 were actually commissioned. John Ericsson's ship served as a prototype for 60-plus ironclads, which followed. Each took on the class of ship name that Ericsson had given his first. Though each had a different name, they were referred to as Monitors. And there were 6 classes of the original, some double-turreted, one even 3-turreted, the Roanoke. And unlike the original, a few followed that were actually seaworthy. Today, all we have of the Virginia is a section of her propeller shaft, which sits on display beside the so-called Confederate White House in Richmond. And the Monitor, in 1973, marine archaeologists located the submerged ironclad 16 miles off the coast of Cape Hatteras, North Carolina. On the 5th of August, 2002, some 140 years after she made naval history, her turret and a remarkable marine engineering achievement was raised. Within, the remains of 2 of the 16 who lost their lives. On the 151st anniversary of the Virginia sortie into Hampton Roads, the 2 found in the turret were buried with full military honors in Arlington National Cemetery. Today, after years of study and restoration, you can do more than read about the historic duel between the ironclads. You can see the Monitor's turret. It can be found at the Batten Conservation Complex, USS Monitor Center, the Mariners Museum and Park in Newport News, Virginia. It is said that necessity is the mother of invention. And for the Union and Confederacy, the American Civil War propelled both toward revolutionary naval innovation. Indeed, after March the 9th, 1862, no major naval power in the world was safe. And so began the post-Civil War race for the navies of the world to catch up. Much has been written about Mary Todd Lincoln, the First Lady of the 16th President, much less about the First Lady of the Confederacy. Next time we gather, the story of the wife of Jefferson Davis, a woman that after the war prompted Columbia political science and constitutional law professor John W. Burgess to write, "If Mr. Lincoln could only have had such a wife." Next up, the intriguing story of Verena Howell Davis. All of us at Threads from the National Tapestry are always excited to hear from those of you who so kindly listen, and for those who decide to help us. We welcome 2 new patrons this particular hour: Parker Lee from Dallas, Georgia, and Brett Nackfor from Mission Viejo, California. Thank you so very, very much for your support. And again, to all, thanks for helping us to make Threads from the National Tapestry a continuing reality. This is Fred Kiger. Thank you for listening.
This podcast is sponsored by The Badge Maker, your go-to source for American Civil War Corps badges and other handmade, American-made historical reproductions. Contact the proprietor, Joseph Valicenti, and place your orders at www.civilwarcorpsbadges.com. That's www.CivilWarCorpsBadges.com.